Good afternoon, and welcome to the Who Is Accuracy Study Workshop. We want to begin this afternoon by introducing the two speakers for the workshop. My name is David Giza. I am the Senior Director of Contractual Compliance for ICANN. And on my right is Jenny Kelly. Jenny is Vice President of Operations for the National Opinion Research Center, which is affiliated with the University of Chicago. Today, what we're going to do in this workshop is share with the community the preliminary findings from the Who Is Accuracy Study. And I'm going to begin by just providing a little bit of background or context behind the purpose of the study, as well as the timeline, so that folks can get a bit grounded in terms of how we've arrived at this point today. And so many of you know that I believe it was approximately about 2 years ago, ICANN began investigating and considering how to best conduct a study with respect to Who Is Accuracy. And it was after much debate inside the community as well as inside of ICANN that we determined that the best way to begin would be with a introductory Who Is Accuracy study. And the purpose of that introductory Who Is Accuracy study was essentially as follows. And let me tell you what that was. You know, we believe that, you know, this study will help to inform the community with respect to statistically valid information that's going to be provided today in the form of preliminary results around the domain names that have been randomly selected and contained in this study. And again, the purpose of this study really is to provide the information that we hope will be useful to the community as we all continue to dialogue and determine how to best address Who Is Accuracy issues in the future. And quite frankly, that could and may involve, you know, future policy development in this area, but that was not one of the objectives of the study. This study was largely undertaken to contribute, again, to the community discussion regarding who is. And so, for purposes of accuracy, we had to determine the definition of accuracy, and you'll see in a moment as Jenny takes you through her work that accuracy for purposes of this study was confined to the name as well as the postal address of the domain. And we did that intentionally because we felt that it would be better to begin in a measured and structured fashion around two important critical elements in who is and examine those elements with reference to previous work that had been done. And some of you were, I believe, in meetings yesterday where we were talking about this topic, and we indicated that in 2005, the United States General Accounting Office conducted a Who Is study. And in 2005, they provided some preliminary results with respect to their findings, and that study is also being replicated in part through the work of ICANN's accuracy study. And Jenny will take you through today her findings with respect to the, you know, again, the replication of the GAO study. So before I turn it over to Jenny, for purposes of the agenda, Jenny will start with a background summary of the work that NORC was retained to perform. Jenny will take you through a detailed review of how the sample, the random sample size, was selected, and the design and the methodology by which the sample size was then put through an analysis and a verification process that produced the preliminary findings that we'll share today. And then there'll be, at the end of that discussion, there'll be some early indicators of what we're referring as barriers to inaccuracy. And then these preliminary findings will be taken from this meeting and then deployed inside of ICANN for further review before we actually post a preliminary draft report which you can expect to see in the November timeframe on ICANN's website. So for the balance of the time remaining, I'm going to turn the floor over to my colleague, Jenny Kelly, and she will take you through approximately 20 or so slides to give you the context and to give you the information that hopefully will result in a very spirited discussion. And I would encourage you, if you have questions as Jenny is proceeding, please ask those questions. I think that will provide a more useful dialogue for us in what's truly intended to be a workshop and hopefully not just a presentation from NORC. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Jenny.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for being here. First thing to start with is what was our universe from which we were sampling? And we made the decision that we would just concentrate on the top five GTLDs. So government, education, and military were considered out of scope, mainly because there's a lot more balances and checks in how those sites are done. And we're looking at basically what covers 98%. We didn't go into the .mobi or the .travel areas because they represent such a tiny proportion overall. Now, to go from, all of the possible records out there down to the sample, there were a few different steps that it went through that we did slightly different things with the sample at different stages. We started with the universe of over 102 million that domain names that were available at the time, and this was earlier this year. We then randomly selected a microcosm of 2,400. Now, this is strictly a proportional systematic random sample. So that 2,400 is very useful in terms of just giving you a very nice miniature representation of what's going on overall. However, for the verification study, we were going to be contacting people directly. And there were 89 countries represented in that first sample, and that would have driven up costs a lot more if we were just chasing down one case in one country, another case in another country. So we clustered the sample up a little by country. And in the end, we ended up with 1,419 domains that we were using for what we call the verification study. Now, the question usually does come up about the sample size, particularly when you're saying, well, how can 2,400 or 419 in the other case come close to representing what's going on in 102 million? Each record here is potentially representing 42,000 records. And that's because in sampling theory, the lovely thing is that it's your sample size that counts a lot. The larger your population size, the less important the sampling fraction actually is. So I can absolutely torture you with the formulas if you like, or you can take my word for it and think about all the political polling you see done, all the polls that are reported in the newspaper. They're nearly always based on between 1,000 and 2,000 cases. But another thing to consider here is what's the power to detect what we want to see? Now, I'm not sort of, some of you who might have done statistics might have awful memories of power calculations and power curves. So this is my much simplified way of getting at this concept. If we've got 1,000, and I'm using 1,000 here just to make the maths a lot easier, if you knew, for example, in the population there really were 10% that had a particular characteristic, then in your sample of 1,000, you would expect 100 cases to have that characteristic. But you all know that when you do sampling, it's a bit of a luck of the draw. Sometimes, a lot of the time, thanks to the central limit theorem, you'll get lucky and you'll end up with a result quite close to the population value. But you can also end up a little way out. So what I've calculated here are basically the confidence intervals for the lower bound. And if we genuinely had 10% in the population, when we just drew our random sample of 1,000, then I would expect 95% of my sample to have a value of at least 75 observations and up to 125 for this particular case. 99% of my samples would give me at least 63. Now, that's nice. Where this gets interesting is to go over to the right-hand side. When your prevalence is very tiny in a population, then you start looking at, well, what is the chances that you'll even pick something up? Part of the reason we went for a larger sample, the 2,400 for part of the study and the 1,400 in the other, was so we could have a reasonable crack at getting at some of the lower incidence rates. Obviously, if you start with a sample of only 100, then your chance of picking up something that's only 1% is actually very low. Your power is very small. In this case, even 1% if you start with a base of 1,000, you should pick up 3 cases. Oh, sorry, you should pick up 10 cases, but on just general sampling variability, you might end up with as few as 3 for among 95% of any possible samples, and you could end up with 0. So one of the things that I want to make the point of here is that if we're looking for things that are of very tiny incidence rate, the fact that it doesn't show up in this sample does not mean it doesn't exist. Now, to move on to the simplest part of this study, and that was replicating the GAO study. The GAO, about in 2005, did basically a desk coding job. They drew a sample of 300 domain names, then they pulled the WHOIS records for those domain names and coded them for, was the entries patently false? And by patently false, I mean not just Mickey Mouse, because somebody perhaps has changed their name to Mickey Mouse, but a series of exclamation marks or some other very inadequate information. Was it incomplete? And that was primarily missing data. And how many were they unable to access the WHOIS data? What's kind of interesting is that 4 years later, not a lot has changed. You can see just running along that the patently false incident has stayed about the same. It's dropped in the .org category, but really at this point the standard errors around those values aren't so fine, particularly when there was only 300 back in 2005. Incompletes, however, have increased, which is interesting because you'd think that with any automated checking of records, incomplete should be the first thing that can leap out and be noticed. There's also been an increase in the inability to access the WHOIS data when you plug in the domain name and nothing comes back, and that percentage has decreased a little across the board. Yeah. I'll actually hand over to Dave for a moment here.
Great. So if you're asking the question again, you know, what's the objective here? You know, we started with the premise that, again, WHOIS is thought to have, you know, a substantial, perhaps, number of inaccuracies, but the extent of those inaccuracies was essentially unknown. We have the 2005 GAO study, which was the first attempt that we were aware of to define the extent of those inaccuracies, and you see that data in front of you. And so our study, again, is attempting to establish a baseline percentage of records containing inaccuracies, and then to identify the nature of those inaccuracies and the barriers to improve accuracy. So let me state that again. Establish a baseline percentage of records containing inaccuracies, and you'll see that chart off to the right, 2009. Identify the nature of the inaccuracies, and you'll see additional information coming later to help explain what those inaccuracies are, and then identifying the barriers that exist to improving accuracy.
Thanks. So, you can tell a reasonable amount from just what's missing and what's patently false, but those two points that Dave just raised are the issues that the GAO study approach wasn't going to be sufficient, because it was looking at only the most obvious errors. People can put in an address that looks perfectly nice. There's a street number, there's a street name, there's a city, there's a postcode, but when you check that address, it may not exist. So that's what we were doing in the verification, and also at the same time trying to look a little more at just not what was the inaccuracies, but to delve a bit more into why they're arising. So, as mentioned, for our verification sample, we did do some clustering by country. But in this chart, you'll see that clustering really didn't skew the sample a huge amount. It is still largely proportional. And part of the reason why it didn't skew it a whole lot is just how dominant the United States still is in the internet world. The next thing is to look at what kind of sites were represented among the cases we looked at. And what is interesting is that the majority of sites are not anything particularly active or useful in a sense. 500, the biggest category, the domain name resolves to absolutely nothing. It's not even redirected onto something else. For about the same number again, you end up at some kind of just blank template or a landing page of some sort, but again, not a site with actual content. Business sites outnumber the personal sites about 2-to-1. And the top-level domain level distribution remains about the same as in the general population. So our working definition of accuracy, and this goes back to the registrar accreditation agreement, which is that there is a correct name, a valid postal mailing address for the current registered name holder.
And I think this is an important point to make here, that when we're talking about a correct name, the intent of the study was to identify, the correct, let's say, legal, valid name of the individual or entity that had, registered the domain. Because we know that domains are registered both in individual names as well as in entities, and so the attempt was to validate or verify in those cases where individuals had registered domain names, validate or verify the name of the individual as accurate.
So to translate this into sort of operational criteria that we could put a measuring stick against, we developed three criteria. One is the address deliverable or not? And that's not just does it look okay, but can we check and make sure that it actually would work if a letter was posted? Yep. So what we're doing there is that we're looking a bit more into whether or not the address exists. You might check that through Google, for example, or you might Google Maps, any other mapping program. We also used post office type checking tools where they are available. The next step is, can the registrant's name, whether it be an individual or an organisation, be linked with that address? And I'll talk more about what the factors that were involved in that later. And then the third stage was, when contacted, does the registrant acknowledge ownership of that domain name? Now, a couple of issues here is that those three criteria aren't strictly successive. I mean, it certainly helps get to the next stage if the earlier criteria is met. But we did manage to contact cases that had undeliverable addresses, for example, by looking, by going through other information in WHOIS or going through the website to see if we could find somebody who still acknowledged ownership of the domain name. So back to the deliverability. What we did was look firstly for completeness. Incomplete address isn't going to go anywhere, so that's an easy code out. If it was a physical address, we were checking it in mapping services to see whether or not that address actually existed. We looked at the postal service checks. So for the United States, for example, there's a lovely database called Smart Mailer, which will tell you before you post a letter if it'll even make it to the destination. And finally, we were looking for things in postcodes for post offices, whether or not the details, the combination was consistent. Short of contacting post offices individually, it's very hard to find out whether or not an actual post box is still live and in range. And post offices aren't able to... A post office box is by its nature a privacy tool, and so they will not release information about even what numbers are active necessarily in their post office.
Elliot, did you have a question?
Yeah, just quickly, was that and or you were checking each of those things or
no,
any of those things?
Any of those things. As soon as we got something that indicated deliverability, we ticked it off and moved on. Now, the good news is a fair few addresses are deliverable. And how you interpret this as a good result or a bad result does depend on your viewpoint. 70% are deliverable street addresses. And I actually classify differently here between street addresses and PO boxes, because street addresses are, by their nature, more informative about the person and they give you more avenues to enable contact. So that's actually just one little consideration for the future, is whether or not post office box mailing addresses are a good idea to accept or not.
Just a quick question about that. Did you at all account for example, there's like mailboxes, et cetera, kind of organizations in the U.S. where it's a street address, and hidden inside the street address is really the box number they have behind it?
Drop points.
Yes.
No, we didn't particularly look for those. If it was a physical address that it could be delivered to, we took it as that. Yeah.
Your last category there is missing, partial, or false. Obviously, there's a lot of addresses that would be deliverable even though they're not complete. But you're saying there it's so partial that it can't be delivered.
That's right. The potentially deliverable probably captures the ones that you're thinking of. If there was a missing, even though, for example, the Smart Mailer tool will throw out things without apartment numbers as problematical, if it was missing an apartment build number, we still treated it, we classified it as potentially deliverable and in broader classifications as deliverable. Similarly, if it was a small enough town or region, sometimes we'd pass it through as potentially deliverable, but if the address was simply Chicago, United States, we figured that wouldn't work.
Jenny, we have a question from James.
Hi, Jenny, and I think you may have just answered it with that last sentence, but where did you categorize rural routes, which are potentially deliverable but may not be a complete address?
Okay, yeah. Actually, mostly as deliverable. Where it's a route and a... mostly as deliverable, unless we couldn't find evidence of that street existing, then it would go down to undeliverable.
And I may be dating myself a little bit, and I may be, my Midwestern may be showing a little bit, but rural route, sometimes they'll just say rural route and then the town.
Yeah, and in that sort of situation, that would still be deliverable because they're small enough. Now, what's interesting here is also the complete but undeliverable category. And this is where this result will be different from the GAO study. The GAO study would have only picked up that little yellow 4% down the bottom. We were actually, because we were looking at things that looked okay but weren't we did discover that there were 8% that appeared okay, but, for example, the street name was... the street didn't exist in either the city or the zip code. I mean, we did apply what would be reasonable correction, what a reasonable person might spend to sort of try and fix an address a little bit. So if it was just a case of a wrong zip code, but the street and the suburb or the street and the city were consistent, we passed that through as a potentially deliverable. So to end up in the complete but undeliverable, there was actually something quite substantially wrong about the address.
We have a question from Christina.
For deliverable street addresses, it's certainly possible in my experience for the street the mailing address to actually exist. In other words, you can deliver mail there, but the person whose address it is has no connection to the domain name. So to the extent that that was your experience, would those get filtered out of deliverable street addresses, or were they considered deliverable regardless of whether or not there was a connection?
I think the next step would address that one. That's where we were trying to look at linkage between the name and the address. At the moment, we're just saying, does the address work at all? So... now, what's kind of interesting isn't just the straight proportions of what's deliverable or not. It's how does that correlate with other information? And basically, if you were asking me to predict in advance where to find the undeliverable addresses, I would now say, don't worry looking among personal or individual sites. Go looking among all of those sites where they resolve to nothing or... it's just a landing site of some sort. Even if I expand that graph up to make it a proportional one, basically the personal sites seem to have reasonable accuracy.
Michaela?
I have concerns here with this page not found classification. How exactly did you test whether a website was being was available on a domain name? Which host names did you test?
Okay, in terms, we weren't testing so much host names. I had a couple of clerks sit down and plug the address into their internet browser and see what came up.
Excuse me, but which address?
Oh, the domain name that was given.
No, I think you're misunderstanding the problem. So you are working on the basis that a domain name equates with an A record, which equates with a web page. In other words, that if I go to www.domain.tld,
yep,
that you expect to find something. Is that correct?
Yes, and even if it was redirected, we still would go found. So I wasn't worrying about redirection. I believe I'm missing a technical point, though, that you're trying to make.
I'd ask you to go to log.ie as a prime example, and then go to b.log.ie, just as... because the point being that you're assuming that people use the domain.tld as a website, and if they fail to do so, that there is no website associated with the domain, which is an incorrect assumption.
Okay, so... I'll catch up with you later about what... how to handle those and further subcategorize them then, or further test them.
Well, you might not be able to, but if you wish to classify a domain name as not being in use or being simply redirected, then you should at least be aware of the fact that you might be misclassifying them entirely. I mean, we have a service which we offer to several thousand users based off a particular .com domain. If you go to the .com by itself, I'm not too sure if it even resolves to anything. However, if you go to cp.thatparticulardomainname.com, you get a login, which is used by hundreds, if not thousands, of users. I have other domains which would be where I would use a domain hack. So I have log.ie, which is log.ie,
right,
which doesn't really go anywhere. But if you go to b.log.ie, it goes to my personal blog.
Okay.
But you'd end up misclassifying the domain.
Okay. Good point.
No, thank you. And in fact, that's why our findings are preliminary, because the objective of the workshop today is to make sure that the work we're doing here is considering all variables, and appreciate the input.
Is there a way that somebody not knowing those additional strokes could check what it went to or not? Or is this just basically an invalid classification to use?
You could try to, you could use certain DNS tools to bring back more data to see what DNS records exist for the domain. If no MX record is associated with the domain name, then it's obviously not going to be used for mail. But assuming that it has to have an A record is a really silly assumption. There are plenty of, we have thousands of clients who only use their domain names for mail. They may not have any A records, however the domain is actively in use, and vice versa.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a question over here to the right.
Hi, Mac Keenan. Another way you can potentially find it is if you search on Google and you type in site, colon, and then the domain.tld, it'll search the subdomain records within Google to see if there are links to, you know, potential subdomains, that sort of stuff.
If we did that, would that meet your concerns?
Yes and no. It's moving in the right direction.
Okay. I mean, if this isn't part of what we were trying to achieve here was to find other ways of looking for detection in the future, if you like, and look at correlates of the problems. The other issue is that, you know, given some of the things that you've described, and if this other method doesn't work, then I would say probably site is something I would drop out of the report.
Well, not necessarily, but I mean, there's certain things you could look at. So, for example, if you're testing a site only on port 80, you're going to get one set of results. If you then switch to testing it over SSL, just to see does it answer for SSL. I mean, a silly example is our office mail server is accessible over SSL for a web interface. It isn't accessible at all on port 80, as far as I know. So, I mean, you can build in a series of checks that will lend a certain degree of validity to it, and obviously actually digging to see if there are DNS records available will tell you or not whether there's something being done. Okay, there obviously you might not be able to get back all the records, but you'll have a much better idea if looking for a site. But I just find that within the ICANN process, a lot of people seem to correlate domain.tld equals content equals use, and forget about the fact that domains aren't just websites.
Okay, good point. All right. Well, at least I feel a bit more comfortable now going onto this slide, because it's less technical, less of a risk. The privacy proxy cases, and we've been checking up the privacy proxy to classify them this way. We're looking at what's advertised on the website and where possible contacting the service itself to say, are you providing a privacy proxy service? And if so, do you represent these domain names? What we've got there is that generally they have pretty good deliverable addresses, which is nice. Where, obviously, you get more problems with deliverability on the addresses when you've got a deliverability or a, you know, missing information on the name, and that's not so surprising. Less issues, too, with organisations, but a few more issues with persons. And when we look at the registrar size, there is actually quite a marked difference. Now, by size, we classified that based on how many domain names were associated with that registrar within our data set. So I think the cutoff point was for large was something like 100. And generally, you can see here that the large registrars tend to have more deliverable records. And so whether or not that's associated with the way that they do the checking, or it could also be a country-based thing because most of the larger ones were more associated with the United States, where there's also some legislative requirements. Okay, so onto the linkage of name and address. If you've got a good name and a good street address, the question is, can we find something in the white pages or somewhere else that links that person? So, for example, if you look me up, you'll find me in the white pages, and even though some people have unlisted numbers, sometimes there's other register entries where they'll be associated with. Post office boxes, no linkage possible. Now, the thing is, though, if we stopped at this point and said we weren't going to search for any linkage if we didn't have a good name and a good address, then we would have ended up with a very small number of people to contact at the end. So ultimately, even when we didn't find a linkage, we did a lot of searching looking for contact numbers that we could contact or ring people on. Particularly, for example, with an address. If there was no name but an address, we would do a reverse search on the address, find a phone number, ring that number, and when somebody answered, say, is there somebody there that we can talk to who knows about this domain? And a lot of the times they would say yes and hand the phone on to somebody. So they're interviews we wouldn't have got otherwise. But you can see here that not a lot of names and addresses line up in the world of who is. We could get a white page, a standard link or stronger in actually only 16% of cases. We found an indirect link for a few more, but when you actually look at the fact that overall street name plus reasonable name was only about 50% of the sample, we really did have to look at other methods for linkage. And this is sort of something I'm looking at in the report, is if we apply this definition very strictly, an awful lot of people fail instantly in inaccuracy. However, we're still able to track down the person reasonably easily. So that's something that I'm still working with to work out what makes most sense for the reporting. Next step was to actually do the confirmation interviews. And here we were actually, I think our maximum number of calls to a single case was in the order of 35. We don't like to go too much beyond that because then people can start feeling harassed. But we were sort of systematically reviewing these cases as we went along to say at what point are they no good. If the number is disconnected after three attempts, well spaced over several weeks, you can be fairly certain it's a disconnected number and it's not worth making a fourth call, for example. In some cases, you might end up racking up a lot of calls because it takes you about eight calls to get the phone answered at the first number, and then they tell you that the person you're after has moved to a new number and they give you a different number, so you start calling that number and you can end up sort of trailing on quite a long distance. So the point I'm trying to make here is that we weren't making just light attempts to contact people. We were really bashing the cases heavily, as we do in a lot of our surveys. We would use all possible contact routes before we gave up on a case. So if the phone number associated with the white pages listing didn't work, we'd do other searches on the name or just the address to see if we could pick them up in any other form. And we've pretty much finished this stage except for a few last cases that we're just sorting out at the moment. In terms of this, not surprisingly, we've had our best confirmation rates among the privacy proxy and the multiple domain holders, largely because you get one person, you can clean up 10 cases. That always helps. Where the name is missing, false or partial, our success rate has been relatively low because we've got very limited information to start with, and that just cripples us from the get-go. Although you still would notice that we've got about 40% of those, and that's either because there was a halfway decent address that had a live phone number associated with it, or there might have been something on their website if there was a website, or we might have gone through the admin contact. Organizations and people, a little better with organizations, and that's pretty much a distribution I'd expect. Now, what we have had is, in terms of contact and confirmation, everybody we have contacted has confirmed. Not necessarily immediately. Sometimes it takes them a while to remember, or we have to persuade them to go and check. But we haven't had anybody go, oh my gosh, that's not possible. You know, it's not like when you get a phone call from the bank saying, did you use your credit card in Nevada last week? And you go, absolutely not, that's not possible, I'm very worried about that. In this situation, we did have some people who didn't immediately know, but the other, and we did do more calls back to just see, was this a possible case of identity theft or similar? And in the end, generally, they did know it, or they acknowledged it, or there was somebody they were working with who uses their name that they were fine about. And that satisfies our definition of accuracy, so they get ticked off.
Were you reasonably confident in that case that they weren't just fed up with you contacting them and saying, giving you the answer they that you were obviously expecting?
No, because people are usually quite happy to slam the phone on us too. Actually, I don't know how our interviewers actually deal with some of the abuse they get.
Yeah, but if people slam the phone down on you, you know, they might well expect the organs just phone back and keep on phoning back until they answer.
Yeah, but look, when somebody's actually trying to give us the flick, they're usually, the ones we phoned back weren't reluctant to talk to us again. It was like they participated in the interview, they got past, they gave us more information, and so when they were called back a couple of weeks later going, look, we just want to double check this to get our numbers right, they were helpful. Okay, so now we get to what were all the natures of the inaccuracies we found. The biggest one is concern about privacy. For all of the cases, you know, the 40% or so of people where there was a false name or a partial name or a false address, when we did speak with them and say, was it deliberate that you left out this information in who is, they said yes. Because of privacy concerns. So that is a very large one. There's also, though, very limited requirements regarding the identity and what proof of identity and what proof of address is needed when you do fill in a who is record. The definition doesn't say that it must be your full name or it must be a registered business. It just has to be a name associated with an address. So that does limit the extent to which you can actually trace people down when they're not using their full name or they're putting in the name of a potential business that maybe one day they'll open, but, you know, it's just an informal concept at the moment. There's certainly a lot of confusion in the meaning of what is the registrant versus the admin contact versus the technical contact versus the billing contact. I suspect people, I'm not too sure what order you always collect this information in when you're a registrant, but sometimes even though the information for the registrant was really poor quality, you look at the admin contact details and there was good quality information there. That's got an issue for how we do handle or how accuracy should be measured. It wasn't clear initially that we would find that there was going to be missing data just simply because they didn't get round to filling in that part of the form. In other cases, it just seemed that they, and in discussion with a couple of respondents, it did just seem that they didn't see the need to pull all that information in. They'd given their information as the admin contact. Did they need to give more information? Next thing is just straight out carelessness on the part of the registrants. And just very odd bits of logic. It's nobody takes the information terribly seriously as they fill it in. I suspect they're fairly careful plugging in their credit card numbers to make sure that the entry goes through, but until that point, there is no sense of ownership. And that's actually the next one, that there is so little value in the domain name ownership. A reasonably common response was, well, yeah, I could own it, but I own a heap of domain names, so I don't know. And that related also to the people who said, well, you know, my brother-in-law does all the web stuff. Maybe, you know, he just sets it all up. I don't know. I'd have to check in with him. That kind of thing is a pretty common theme, particularly even the ones that we spoke to who at first said, no, I don't think I own that, and we were, you know, hoping, getting excited that maybe we had a nice case of identity theft, and ultimately they all fizzled out with, you know, people just saying, oh, I forgot, or it was a while ago. The last thing, of course, is the ASCII translation aspect, and you're all over that anyway with the internalization or IDNs, that's easier to say. So that's a well-known issue. Before we go on, any questions about this slide? Oh, no, we've got one. I think, you know, particularly when people are just new to the game, they're not professionals, they're filling in a form and they're not sure what to put where. And it probably, this goes back to a sort of a form design aspect, but a quarter of the sample that we spoke to had never even heard of WHOIS. For some people, they're not even aware that that this information goes into a register. I mean, presumably, and you know, in a couple of the cases I've checked, there are the obvious and usual disclaimers or, you know, notices that this happens. But a lot of people don't read that. They're just plugging in information, trying to get something up. In some cases, yes, and in some cases, they were probably putting in inaccurate information because they knew it would go somewhere. I mean, you know, people were concerned about the privacy aspect, definitely, but when you look at the cases where there's decent information in the admin contact and in the technical contact and just partial information in the registrant section, then it's not a case that they deliberately left that information out or thought, I don't want that information in there. It's just because they obviously gave it a couple of rows down in the admin. I just don't think a lot of the, you know, Joe average in the population doesn't appreciate what they're doing when they're filling in these forms.
On your last point, ASCII translation, does that mean that there's a situation where someone has entered the information in a script other than ASCII and somehow it has appeared incorrectly?
No, I'm thinking of a lot of the Chinese cases where they, and Turkish and Russian, where they've entered in a translation, which is the nearest best translation for them. But the problem is when you go back to those countries to look up registers, then those registers are in the original script and it's not necessarily a one-to-one translation. So even when they enter the information in English, for example, or using ASCII characters, it doesn't help you find them back in a country where all the phone books are not in ASCII characters. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of what I was asking. This is this would be something where I'll pursue this off.
Okay. The short aspect there is that I think we would have had more luck had we had the original characters. There's only about a handful of cases where it looked like they tried to enter it in something else or it was appearing. But again, depending on which server and which registrar it was, that didn't necessarily come through cleanly. Okay, because I didn't find any direct cases of deception. I'm sure there are, and I'm sure in that group of people that we were never able to track down, there are cases. But we didn't actually find those cases. So a question is, can whois be made accurate? And fundamentally, I think the quick answer at the moment is possibly not the way things are at the moment. Going back to the way, this is basically a model that was set up many years ago when the internet was a very different sort of place. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, if I was going to ask you, what information would you trust most? An entry in a telephone book, an entry in whois, or an entry in a motor vehicle registry, which would you take as reliable? Anybody go for whois? I mean, there's just... And you kind of go, well, other registry systems have grappled with accuracy and a few other concepts, and so in trying to get to what the issues are here, it's worth sometimes contrasting how whois operates with how other registries operate. And I think the most significant thing is privacy provision. That's in the phone book, for example, you can choose to opt out and have an unlisted number. So there's not that, you're not giving people a motivation to lie or give only partial information. The more correct information exists somewhere, it's just not made public and out in the public domain. Input requirements is are another one. Pretty much you can sign up and get a domain name with no proof required. Presumably as long as your credit card works at the moment that you're putting the information in, you're good to go. Now, checking proof of identity and proof of address, that's a whole nother ball of wax that, you know, might not be appropriate because when you're dealing with a fundamentally electronic medium, you don't want to be slowing it down. You don't want to be having checks in people sort of sending in copies of their license or anything like that. But it is an issue to consider. If you don't have any restrictions or checks on what people enter, you can't expect necessarily that they'll enter good stuff anyway. Even just an accidental error will go through, even if they're not doing it deliberately. Yeah.
Oh, Steve.
Well, 2 points. First, I wonder if perhaps you are making some conclusions here based on the sample that you were looking at. You were looking at the five largest GTLDs, and for them, what you describe as the registration process, I think you've accurately described it. There are GTLDs that, for which there is some form of verification required before you can register. So this is—I don't think this is necessarily a problem of whois. It's a problem of the issue of what are the requirements for a particular registry or registrar in terms of ensuring accuracy.
Yeah. I mean, that was the reason we didn't even go near the .govs or the .edus. You know, they are going to be more accurate.
Right. Well, but, and I mean, there are many other examples, but That's one point. And the other point, I wonder, I mean, some of what you're saying is that anything that's entered will be accepted. Is that necessarily the case? I mean, do registries, or actually registrars in this case, use automated error checking?
Well, clearly some do. I mean, that goes back to the finding that the largest registrars generally had the cleanest data in terms of the least incidence of missing or crap data. So there are obviously, you know, some checks that are being done by some registrars.
So is your question here, can whois be made 100% accurate, or can whois be made more accurate? Maybe those are two different questions.
Okay, and I'm not even going to buy into the argument about how accurate does it need to be, because I do think that that's a way bigger policy discussion. Yeah.
Well, what's the point of doing this? This is what I'm failing to understand. I mean, we know that the data that's going into whois isn't ever going to be 100% accurate. So what's the end game?
Well, at the moment, because this is just the beginning game, we wanted to develop a baseline around accuracy or inaccuracies and then use that information constructively in future studies that will be conducted by ICANN's policy team. And so I think what we're trying to do today is report on our analysis and our findings. The conclusions we draw aren't... quite honestly, they haven't been drawn yet from the data because we haven't finished all of the analysis yet and the findings aren't complete. But we wanted to share this information at this stage with the community to get input in terms of, you know, what else we might need to look at or consider as, you know, as we complete this work. Again, designed to just get some baseline information on name and postal address for purposes of accuracy. Now, many in the industry, such as yourself, may already have the conclusions drawn, and you may even have some recommendations on how to improve the level of accuracy, and that would be useful information for, you know, for discussions that follow in the upcoming policy studies.
Yeah, but the question I have really is, I mean, what is the purpose of having accurate whois? I mean, it's a very simple question. I know it's a loaded question.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, well, I guess it depends who you ask, right? But you know, certainly from but certainly from my perspective, you know, one objective of ICANN is to continue to assess and to assist in improving and enhancing the level of accuracy inside of whois. How we do that is a question for debate. And so many of you know that in our team, the contractual compliance team, we have a whois data problem reporting system, and that's a tool that we use to gather information about whois inaccuracies and then provide that information back to registrars who then, you know, generally, if not in most cases, take action to address those inaccuracies with their customers. Elliot?
Yeah, I thought it might be helpful to relate a little anecdote that really surprised me today. You know, we had, you know, as you guys know, we got a little sort of sneak peek at this in the registrars yesterday. And, you know, I was really struck by yesterday how the inaccurate data, you know, is really not in any way connected to nefarious purposes, but to simple kind of, you know, innocuous reasons. You know, I wasn't super surprised at that, but you know, what I did was take that back into a retail business and say, hey, you know, we really probably should do some stuff to clean up that inaccurate data because it might be costing us renewals. You know, I saw a good short-term opportunity. And I was assured, you know, by the guy who ran that business, who has a lot of experience with whois over the years, that no, for him it was no problem because his customer data that he kept, which was completely separate from whois, was an order of magnitude more accurate. And so he didn't have this renewal problem at all. It was really the purpose that you know, sort of we all see whois as this, you know, kind of sanctified data set. But, you know, the people who are actually delivering services to end users treat it very differently. And you know, what I found very interesting about that is because, you know, again, we're all in here drinking our own bathwater, and you know, thinking that when it comes to enforcement at whatever level, whether that's legal, intellectual property, et cetera, the places where this is typically being looked to make recourse to, that, you know, probably the much more effective and accurate data set is with hosting companies. And, you know, there was some really interesting implications for me there, because I immediately cast my mind back, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and I cast my mind back to before competition in the domain space, when that was what everybody did. You know, we didn't really bother with who is for enforcement. It was much more, you know, go to the hosting company for enforcement. And so I just, you know, I was really struck by, you know, kind of the experience of walking through that, and thought I would share it, and it might be helpful for you as you're kind of planning your next steps, and we're all planning our next policy steps.
Yeah, Elliot, thank you. That is constructive information that will be useful both to our team as well as to policy staff. I think we have a question here first, and then we'll come back here. Okay.
I'd say the two biggest groups that are concerned about this and that complain about it on a regular basis are people concerned about consumer protection and trademark protection, primarily. And I would suggest that they're most interested in the people that you probably weren't able to find that fall in deceptive categories. So my biggest concern about these results is that there's a huge amount of effort went into understanding the causes of what might be regarded as accidental or inconsequential inaccuracies, as opposed to the group that is probably of greatest concern, which are the people that are trying to take advantage either of corporate trademarks or of unsuspecting consumers, et cetera, that fall into this dark category about which the study reveals almost nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, the good news there is that our work isn't finished. And so, again, with, you know, the kind of constructive input you're giving us today, it gives us the opportunity to talk with NORC and determine what methodologies would be appropriate to do that drill down, and to see if we could discover, you know, the information that isn't being presented today. Go ahead, Jay.
I believe your point is well taken, and I think that the malicious conduct seminar we had from law enforcement that scared me to death is clearly shows that the big problem is contract enforcement, because what happens is you either have players in the market who have these terms and aren't enforcing them, and that's where all the dark horses are. That's where they hide. That's where all the roaches go.
What terms are you referring to? What terms are those?
The terms of their agreement with ICANN.
Sorry, translators. I don't know which terms you're talking about.
There are AA, the commitments they make to provide accurate information.
The terms requiring what?
Them to provide accurate who is information. They don't enforce that. They don't do any checking. They don't police their own market. And so that's where people go, because they know they're not going to be found, because the entity that is operating the interface with the Internet is not living up to its responsibilities.
Well, thank you for that vote of confidence. But let's move over here to the right and get a point of view as well.
I think the other problem with surveys in particular is just by the nature of who they select, I don't think that sort of information about malicious behavior will ever come out in a survey. If you walk down the street in New York and stopped 100 people and asked them if they were muggers, you're pretty good chance that all 100 will say no.
That point well taken. We have a question here on the right.
It's Lee Bygrave, University of Oslo. Not so much a question, but an attempt at constructive input. It might be an idea, following on the remarks of the gentleman from the USA here, to have a look at the contractual provisions, particularly in the RAA, because it would seem that those provisions are a little bit flabby when it comes to delineating what exactly registrars have to do to check accuracy. There's not much guidance for them, And plus the registrants themselves, as you were implying in your study, they don't really bear the cost of non-compliance, apart from the fact that they have to give up their domain name. But that's often quite rare. And if they don't have a sense of ownership of the domain name in the first place, then the incentive to provide accurate data, the legal incentive, isn't really there. I've got a quite interesting legal report on who is issues, and particularly accuracy issues, which I can feed into you guys after the meeting.
That'd be great. Thank
you. Yeah, if you would, I'd appreciate it. A question from Steve Metallics first, and then Elliot, you're next.
No, I just wanted to say that I completely agree with what the last speaker said, and if those who share that concern, if you stay in your seat for another 20 minutes, we will be having a meeting in here of the group that's working on identifying potential amendments to the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, and a lot of them deal with the flabbiness that you referred to, and what can we do about it, and are there ways to make it a stronger contract. So I would encourage you to stay right here.
Hello.
Great, thanks. And I just wanted to say I couldn't disagree more with both of you. And you know, this goes, rather than to the accuracy point, to the purpose of who is discussions, which we've all been having for, going on 10 years now, you know, and aren't going to be settled here, but can and should be settled at a policy level.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to ask Jenny to continue because Steve correctly pointed out that we have a little under 20 minutes left in the session.
Okay. Well, the good news is that we're on about the fifth last slide at this point. This is my second last slide. And a lot of these points have just come up in various discussions around the table. You know, you've got the old concept of garbage in, garbage out, and really that's what we're dealing with in a lot of respects with who is, because there is no privacy provision whatsoever beyond people using a privacy or a proxy service. I mean, those are up now for at least 15% of the cases, given that unlisted phone numbers usually run between 20 and 30%, I would say those privacy and proxy services have risen to meet a need that people feel. We've mentioned about, you know, the requirements about proof and what information is given and whether or not it has to be a street address. There's no link, and this is something that Elliot mentioned, going back to the link to the credit cards, you know. I do believe that the customer databases are impeccable in their quality. And that could be one way a linking could clean things up a little for who is. There's just the risk of an error or an omission being detected, particularly, you know, I would say the automated checkers are looking for the lack of for blank fields. But for an undeliverable address or a fake name, you know, I would say that the chance of that being detected is generally very tiny. And there are the zero consequences. The next thing is just, if you can't clean things up as they go into a system, then the next step is, how good are your systems to detect and clean up errors once they're in there? And basically, the way WHOIS is structured at the moment, within registries, registrars can possibly do more checking, but one of the biggest nightmares of this job was actually dealing with the mess of data, which is the output that you get from a WHOIS query. Totally different fields, different registrars have very different ways of presenting the data. I mean, yes, it's all there. You can, after a lot of digging around, find all the required fields, but they're in different places. Last thing is that validation prospects are really limited if you don't ask for certain information to be required or provided. So, in a sense, it did get a little frustrating going, well, I've got a name here that says Joe, and I have a town. Can I find Joe in that town? Even if it was an actual street address. So I'm going to hand it back to Dave now at this point.
Okay. Just two quick slides, and then we'll open it up for some final comments and questions. You know, many folks have asked, what does ICANN intend to do with the results from this baseline study? And I thought I'd offer some answers to that question in this session today. We were empowered and engaged to conduct the study for purposes of further informing the community with respect to the findings of this study on accuracy regarding name and postal address. Secondly, we do believe that this information will be extremely useful to our policy team as the policy team launches a variety of who is related studies, which will more than likely result in who is related policy work. And those will be forthcoming in the coming calendar years as this work continues. Certainly, we wanted to share today's findings with the GNSO Council that's been empowered to investigate and work on potential RAA amendments in the future. And Steve Metallitz mentioned that group will be meeting in here in approximately 15 minutes. And so many of those members are here today, and they've seen this information. And as we complete our analysis and complete the findings, there'll be a draft report posted on the website for public review and comment, and then a final report that will most likely be produced in the January-February timeframe of 2010. And then finally, from the perspective of the contractual compliance team, what might we do with the findings from this study? And I think there, I've talked with my colleagues, Stacey Burnett and Pam Little, about, how we might improve who is related compliance enforcement work. And in particular, what enhancements we might consider to the Who Is Data Problem reporting system. And those enhancements could, again, produce, incremental improvement in the overall, composition and collection of data in the Who Is, collective database. But we have no hard and fast positions on that at the moment because, again, these findings and this work has not been completed. And at the same time, we realize there are future policy studies that will go much deeper into certain aspects of who is than this study has. This has been a baseline study with a very, very narrowly focused, on two particular, areas of inaccuracy. Jenny, if you could do the next slide, please. And so where we're at the moment is that you will find that our team continues to work closely with ICANN's policy team, and we'll support their work as those studies are launched in the coming calendar year. And I think many of you know that you'll be able to find information related to this study as well as the potential and additional Who Is studies on ICANN's webpage, and you see the web address there. And I would encourage everyone in this room and outside of this room to stay engaged in the debate. It was pointed out that these questions have been asked for 10 or more years, and we won't have answers overnight, and we won't have solutions that will result overnight either. I think this is an incremental process that will produce incremental change that will ultimately help the global community move forward in producing higher and more trusted level of accuracy. But that will only result, I think, as we complete these additional studies and then use all of that information collaboratively as a community here to determine what policy efforts need to be undertaken and to determine, what contractual amendments need to be, debated and then deployed in the, in the registrar accreditation agreement in order to arrive at levels of accuracy that the community deems acceptable if we are going to continue to use the Who Is collective database or registry in the structure and format that it is today. I suspect that with the help of folks in this room and elsewhere, those tough questions will get answered, and we certainly hope that in the coming year we'll have more information and we'll have recommendations that will drive a change in the ultimate accuracy of Who Is. And so at this point, I'd like to just open it up for some final questions or comments in the 10 minutes remaining. Over here to the right.
So my name is Jim Galvin from Phileas, and speaking as a registry services provider, two slides ago you had a statement that said that automated Who Is inaccuracy detection can really only be performed at the registry.
And I have to tell you that taken out of context, that statement sure scares me a lot. And I would hope that that statement would never be taken out of context. You know, clearly that's not a true statement in the general case. I realize in the context of this study it might be. But especially for generic TLDs, you know, with you know, international scope, there's not a chance that that's a true statement.
Right. I think my point was more that ICANN doesn't have much of a hope of doing it. Just the pain we went through to extract these 2,400 records was horrendous.
Okay, do we have any more questions or comments from anyone here in the audience today? Over here to the left.
Yeah, I have a couple of observations. One is that while it sounds very easy to do this electronically, those systems have been worked and have been also leveraged by criminals. And it's not as easy to do as just plugging it into a credit card service and saying yay or nay over that. I mean, you could do that, but then what are you going to do in, I don't know, 60% of the developing world that doesn't have those kinds of services? There's just like tons of corner cases to the who is validation problem. And as somebody who's actually tried to do this at governmental level for election registration information and had real live experiences with both CITES information and real people information, it's a daunting problem, even in a developed society. The other question that, or the other observation that I had is that I just tried to Google search real quick and find out what percentage of Americans move every year. And I think it's about 8 to 12%, depending upon.
Actually, it's about 20%.
Is it 20%? Okay. So there you give another dimension to the problem that a registrar or a registry will have in terms of where you're going with trying to keep this information alive. So just, it's a very complicated problem, even on the like Pollyanna side of the world.
I really appreciate your comments there. In terms of the one thing I haven't reported here as inaccuracies were the number of, when we interviewed people and said, now is this information accurate? You're right. I mean, a lot move. And it is, part of my view is that at the moment there's very little checking or cleaning done. You know, it's how incremental do you go? But then again, like, you know, is moving from, let's say, you know, arbitrarily 50% accuracy to 60% accuracy going to do any good? Maybe, maybe not.
Okay, well then I think at this point we'll close the workshop for today. I want to thank everyone for their participation and constructive comments. We still have work to do before these findings are released in a draft report. And I would encourage anyone who has further interest in the topic and in the study to reach out to, you know, to either Jenny or myself so that we can make sure that your comments, your questions, your feedback is incorporated in our work. And please, you know, do look forward to, you know, seeing a preliminary draft report posted, again, in the most likely the November, December timeframe. And so with that, we'll close the workshop for today. And, again, thanks to all for attending.